From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, just 3 days left until a possible government shutdown, and Republicans have a new proposal to keep the government funded through mid-February. The stopgap spending measure would not address the future of the hundreds of thousands of young immigrants brought to the U.S. illegally, something Democrats were pushing for. Instead, it would be paired with a long-term funding plan for the Children's Health Insurance Program, known as CHIP or S-CHIP. Here's Speaker of the House Paul Ryan today.
I used to think that the Democrats thought the S-CHIP bill was bipartisan, that children's health insurance is a bipartisan bill. This was written by Republicans and Democrats. We've passed this extension twice this year. We're going to be bringing it to the floor again this week because real deadlines are occurring this Friday.
Joining us now is NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, Jeremy.
And tell us more about what Republicans are proposing here. I don't know if we call this Plan B or C or whatever, but what does it say?
I don't know what letter of the alphabet we're up to at this point, but it is a stopgap funding measure that would keep the government open until February 16th. It would include, as Paul Ryan was talking there about the Children's Health Insurance Program, a six-year reauthorization of that. And that's pretty key because he's trying to get Democrats on board to support something to kind of browbeat them into that. It would also have some measures related to the Affordable Care Act, including extending a two-year delay on the ACA-related taxes on medical devices and so-called Cadillac plans. Those are plans that are high value and would extend 1 year delay of the ACA-related health insurance tax. And there's a defense-related provision to provide more money for missile defense. So, you know, again, something that they're trying to buy some more time to negotiate when it comes to DACA, the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals. But again, this does not deal with DACA specifically.
Would Democrats be willing to vote against this extension of the CHIP funding if it also means voting for a bill that doesn't deal with DACA?
Well, that's the vice that Paul Ryan is trying to put Democrats in at this point. That's why he's trying to bring CHIP into this, because Democrats really want to be able to try to make a deal on DACA. And it means that Paul Ryan's not confident that he can pass this just with his conference alone, getting 218 with just Republicans. And we heard the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus say, quote, the votes are not currently there to pass it with just Republicans.
If DACA is not part of this bill, what happens to the Dreamers?
They're waiting. They are hung in some kind of limbo still, where March 5th is the expiration of the executive order that President Trump rescinded, the 6 month window. So there would be 1 month left, or less than that, 3 weeks to get something passed to extend their current stays.
Another thing I want to ask you about is Steve Bannon, the president's former strategist. He was on Capitol Hill yesterday, questioned for 10 hours behind closed doors by the House Intelligence Committee. He was later subpoenaed by that panel. What do we know about what happened in that hearing?
Well, we know that a lot of lawmakers think that Bannon was not very forthcoming, that he was trying to invoke executive privilege, in other words, to say that he shouldn't have to reveal what he knows about being in the West Wing, although we hadn't heard from the White House that they wanted him to necessarily invoke executive privilege or that the White House was doing that on his behalf. We do know, though, that he has been subpoenaed by the special counsel, Robert Right. Mueller, and he says that he's going to be more forthcoming with them.
What does that signal to you?
Well, that the White House has said that they don't care what he says to them, that he needs to be forthcoming and say what he knows about these various meetings. And what it says to me is that he wants to be cooperative with the special counsel to avoid any kind of charges against himself if there was anything possibly that they could deal with on him. And, you know, they're going to try to leverage him to see what they can get about anybody else close to the president.
Finally, Domenico, some new news on the allegations of an affair between President Trump and the porn star Stormy Daniels. The Wall Street Journal earlier reported that she was paid $130,000 to stay silent about it. Daniels says that was false and she never had a sexual relationship with Trump. But today, a 2011 In Touch magazine interview resurfaced in which she claims they did have an affair. Is this story going anywhere?
Well, you know, the White House vehemently denies that this took place. They point to Stephanie Clifford, who is the real name of Stormy Daniels, who has her stage name is Stormy Daniels, that she has denied it herself. They deny any payment at this point. But I do think that this is the kind of story that it's remarkable that it just kind of gets brushed off, you know, that people maybe aren't surprised or it's not that big of a thing when it comes to President Trump. If this were any other president who was being right. accused of having an affair while he was married and his wife had just had their baby, this would be major, major news. But amid the storm of chaos of everything else, nobody's talking about it.
NPR lead politics editor Domenico Montanaro. Domenico, thank you.
Hey, you're welcome.
Let's turn now to the latest on those two Navy ship collisions last year that killed a total of 17 sailors. In both cases, the Navy destroyers collided with much larger commercial ships, and it looks likely the commanding officers of the USS Fitzgerald and the USS John S. McCain will face serious criminal charges. Greg Myrie is NPR's national security correspondent. Greg, what possible charges could these officers face?
Well, very serious charges indeed. Negligent homicide, dereliction of duty, endangering a ship. This is what a four-star admiral has recommended for the charges to the commanders of each of these ships. Now, this will go on to something called an Article 32 hearing, which is the military's equivalent of a grand jury to formally press the charges. But it certainly seems to be moving in that direction.
Well, remind us what happened. Just a terrible scenario. 17 sailors total dying. What happened?
Right. So the first one was the USS Fitzgerald in June. It hit a cargo ship off Japan. Seven were killed. The commander, Bryce Benson, was asleep in his room. He was thrown about, almost tossed overboard, had to be rescued. He was injured, had to be flown off the ship by helicopter. So this was the first of these very serious and very unusual collisions. And then just 2 months later, in August, the USS John S. McCain hit an oil tanker off Singapore. This is a very crowded waterway, and 10 were killed there. And these two destroyers, these are agile ships, very sophisticated. They should be able to avoid accidents, especially in sort of routine operations like this. So the death toll in the McCain, the 10 dead, is, as far as we can tell, this is the deadliest collision of a Navy ship since back in the 1960s.
Just terrible. But what does it reflect? Because the Navy investigated, they determined the accidents were avoidable and showed failures by personnel on the ships, but also, you know, that the crews were not adequately prepared.
Yeah, we've already seen a considerable bit of fallout. The commander of the 7th Fleet was fired. Two other senior commanders in the 7th Fleet were dismissed as well. 7th Fleet is, in terms of size and responsibility, is really the largest foreign-based fleet. It's based in Japan. It's got 60 to 70 ships responsible for all the waters off the Asian shores. And we should also note that on the ships, the Fitzgerald and the McCain, five others are also likely to face criminal charges. So this is something that is both taking effect on those sailors who are on the ships as well as the higher-ups.
Well, terrible thing for the families to hear that the crews, you know, as part of this Navy report, that the crews just didn't know how to respond to the failure and didn't respond quickly enough. A terrible thing to hear. But in addition to a lot of other punitive action, there's also been recommendations. So tell us about both.
Right. So this has prompted a large investigation, and worth noting there were two other lesser accidents in Asia last year with no fatalities. And so this big investigation took place, and the report came out in November. And as you noted, it said that these were avoidable collisions. And sort of at the ship level, it said that there were just basic mistakes in seamanship. The crew wasn't communicating well. There was poor judgment, and when they realized that they were in danger, something might be wrong, there might be a collision, they didn't respond quickly or wisely. But the Navy also looked at this much more broadly, and in terms of the way that it's training commanders to drive ships and training all its seamen, and they found out that there has been ineffective command and shortcomings in training, and so they're looking at this as a broad systemic failure that led to some of these specific specific mistakes where the accidents took place.
Yeah, I mean, they're recommending things like more sleep, stress management for sailors, a better sense of how to use the equipment. So a lot of changes. How is this reverberating in the military?
Oh, I'm sure it's having a very powerful effect in the Navy. Again, extremely rare to even have a collision. Now, commanders will tell you that if you do this long enough, you will have some close calls, but they're trained to deal with them. So the sense that you had these four Asian collisions or three collisions and a grounding last year, two of them with these fatalities, highly unusual, and it is forcing this sort of top-to-bottom review about the way they conduct business.
Yeah, at least eight top Navy officers, including the 7th Fleet Commander, were fired from their jobs last year as a result of this. NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie. Greg, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
McDonald's announced this week that all of its packaging worldwide will be made from recycled, renewable, or certified sources by 2025. Currently, only about half is. The company will also add recycling bins to every restaurant. Joining us now is Francesca DiBiase, Chief Supply Chain and Sustainability Officer at McDonald's. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, Jeremy.
And why make this change now?
Well, McDonald's has the opportunity and, quite frankly, the responsibility to use our size and scale for good to address important environmental challenges. And we also know that our customers care about this. In a survey, packaging waste is the top environmental challenge they'd like us to address. So it's part of us really being a better McDonald's by listening to our customers and addressing environmental concerns that we share with them.
But why now? Did attitudes change so much recently that you wouldn't have wanted to do this 5-10 years ago?
I think it's really part of our growth in the business development. We talk much more about listening to our customers. It's been a very successful part of our turnaround, and we just feel like now's the right time to start listening to our customers on environmental concerns and coming up with solutions that we can because of our size and scale.
How much is this going to cost McDonald's?
It's really hard to put a number on it, especially as recycling infrastructure varies market to market. But what we can do is we'll use our global supply chain capabilities to come up with the best new packaging designs. The expectation is that we'll be using less packaging, which will save us money, and we'll be able to reinvest that money to help meet our goals. The challenge that we'll have is meeting our second goal of having recycling options in all of our restaurants, as today we recycle in just about 10% of our restaurants globally.
Yeah, tell us about that challenge to be able to offer recycling, because, you know, you think about McDonald's, they might be in the middle of a large city, but it could also be in a very remote place that might not have, you know, local recycling capability.
You're right. And especially as you see how it varies around the world so significantly, recycling infrastructure, regulations, and consumer behaviors vary city to city, country to country, and even here in the U.S., municipality by municipality, which makes it very complex. Having said that, one of the unique things about McDonald's is that we're part of so many communities around the world, so we are able to work with local municipalities and our local franchisees to implement various recycling programs and also have the opportunity to educate our customers and restaurant employees community by community.
Yeah, I saw that one aspect of this is you've got to train people on how to recycle because in some places maybe they're not used to it.
Well, you know, even for myself, you know, sometimes you'll go in somewhere and it's very complex to understand how to recycle. So today, for example, one of the things we're doing in the U.S. is we're currently featuring the How to Recycle logo on many of our packaging items to educate our customers on how to properly recycle when they leave our drive-through.
One of the things that our producer brought up in looking into this story is that when you go to McDonald's, you might get, you know, a million napkins in your bag or, you know, 10 ketchup packets that you're never going to use. Is that part of this plan as well to deal with that?
Well, yeah, that'll certainly be part of educating our restaurant employees as we move forward. But you'll see a lot of other changes, and customers may see other changes. For example, today in the UK, almost 80% of our restaurants offer recycling bins within the restaurant, so customers sort on their own. In other places like Germany, the crew sorts in the back of the house for the customers. So I think we'll, again, have to look at a variety of solutions to meet these goals.
Do you anticipate any backlash from customers about changing materials?
Well, one of the things we need to make sure is that we change materials that are important to our customers, right? So we all want to feel good about what we eat and where it comes from. Customers want their food to be hot and safe and high quality, and packaging is part of that experience. So we certainly have to continue to make sure we meet customers' needs on that side as well.
What's the most difficult single item to change the packaging of? Is there one thing that you're like, oh, how are we going to replace this and make it work as well as it does?
So we are focusing on 100% of our packaging. So that's a combination of fiber-based packaging as well as plastics. And certainly one of the things we're looking at is, cups. Mm-hmm. There's been a lot of work in the industry related to cups, and finding a cup for cold drinks that lasts as long as our customers may want to keep it, in their cup in their car throughout the day. That's been a challenge for us. So we'll be looking to find things that are planet-friendly and also cost-effective in the area of cups.
Do you expect your competitors to follow you on this?
As the world's largest restaurant company, we're focused on using our scale for good to make a meaningful impact. And it's great if what we do inspires others.
That's Francesca DiBiase, who is Chief Supply Chain and Sustainability Officer at McDonald's. Francesca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Lawmakers in the United Kingdom might be taking things a step further. They're debating a new tax on disposable cups to cut down on waste. The so-called latte levy is controversial, but proponents say it could replicate the success of Britain's tax on plastic bags, which led to an 80% reduction in plastic bag use since it was introduced in 2015. For more, we're joined by Simon Ellen. He's chief executive of the Recycling Association, a group supporting the proposed tax. Simon, why do you think this is the best way to reduce waste?
It's the best way to reduce waste because what we've been trying to push through as the Recycling Association is producer responsibility. And we think that for so long, responsibility has just been passed down the supply chain, so to the municipalities and to the processors and to export markets, whereas the people right at the top of the supply chain, the manufacturers, the designers, the retailers, the supermarkets, the coffee shops, have really, I think it's fair to say, shirked their responsibility in this, and that they've just passed the problem on and have done nothing about it. I don't think that the UK have possibly got the, as it's called, the latte levy absolutely correct, because the onus has been placed on the consumer, whereas I think we think that more onus should be placed on the producer. But I think the ethos behind it, that we're trying to change consumer habits, I think is a very good one and a very robust one, and has proven to work with the carrier bag tax that we have in the UK now, which has reduced carrier bag usage by 80%. And we're hoping that similar will happen for coffee cups, and then that can be transposed into other materials too.
Well, then, is the goal really to just make it so inconvenient for somebody to get a paper cup when they go and get a coffee, so that they decide, I'm going to bring a reusable cup with me and take it out in that way? Is that the way that you would like this to work?
I think that's the way that the MPs who have suggested this, that's how they see it working. And that is, a similar way to how we see it working for a variety of materials, with coffee cups being the first one. And that's exactly the idea. Human nature says if it's going to cost you more, then, you'll take the cheaper option, and that would be to bring your own mug as far as possible. I do think it's probably got its limitations, and I'm probably as guilty as anybody. When I'm catching a train or I'm on the run, then I probably wouldn't always have a coffee cup with me.
Right.
And it is changing the way that the general public perceive waste and recycling.
Well, so what about just requiring all of these companies to make recyclable cups so that even if you do have to grab a paper cup, you can recycle it?
I mean, I think I have no doubt whatsoever that, you know, with technological advances, and there's, you know, there's already prototypes out there, that will happen. We have two processing mills in the UK that can actually recycle coffee cups, you know, in their current form with the plastic lining. Mm. The problem is that how do you get them to those mills in the sufficient quantities that they need to then be able to recycle them? Because, you know, they are used on the go. People will stuff the lid in the coffee cup. It will have the detritus of the liquid. It will maybe have a stirrer. It will maybe have a tea bag. And there are no receptacles, or very, very few receptacles in the UK. There's one or two springing up now, you know, to actually collect the cups in the first place. So just because you design a recyclable coffee cup doesn't necessarily mean that it will be recycled, of course.
Did you consider the option of a voluntary system where stores like Starbucks and Costa Coffee would just do this on their own without having an actual tax?
Well, I mean, I think this is probably half of it, to be honest. I think that this tax, if you like, that, you know, it is designed really to get the likes of Costa and Starbucks to come to the table, because, you know, ultimately, you know, they want to attract people through their doors. Sustainability, recycling, plastics is very, very high on the UK agenda at the moment. And I think if there's any danger that they lose custom, you know, through the different practices or through the fact that the coffee is becoming too expensive, then, you know, you can bet your life that it will bring them to the table. And, you know, already we are hearing, you know, of some of the big drinks producers, you know, coming up with ideas and plans of how they might handle it. And I think, yeah, that is three quarters of the idea of bringing this up in the first place.
That's Simon Ellen, who is chief executive of the Recycling Association. It's a group in the UK that is supporting Britain's proposed latte levy on disposable cups. Simon, thanks for joining us.
Pleasure.
And let us know if a latte levy would change your behavior when it comes to coffee cups at hereandnow.org.
This podcast and following message sponsored by WBUR.
Hi, I'm Ben Brock Johnson, here to introduce you to Endless Thread, a new podcast from WBUR and Reddit featuring stories that capture the internet's endless permutations of human potential.
Even though it's like this huge network with millions of users, you know, there's still that kind of like small world connection there.
Endless Thread, supported by ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire, and by Wistia, where videos get put to work. Learn more at wbur.org/endlessthread and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Ohio has now become the latest state to expand its Medicaid program to cover an alternative treatment to manage pain. In Ohio's case, it's acupuncture, but other states are also paying for massage and yoga to fight the opioid crisis and addictions that often are started by overprescription of pain drugs. Casey Ross reports on this for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. And Casey, the effort here is to give low-income patients the same non-opioid options that many people who are insured have, because some of these things are covered by insurance. But what's the science behind it?
Well, it varies from treatment to treatment, but there is limited scientific evidence to support the benefits that some of these therapies offer in treating different forms of pain. Acupuncture in particular has a pretty varied body of evidence to support it, and it's really not conclusive that, you know, the delivery of that particular kind of treatment provides a significant benefit to specific patients.
But the people backing these moves say it might give just a little bit. In other words, it might be one tool in a toolbox that might include other things like massage and like chiropractic.
Well, that's right. I mean, if it helps, it helps, regardless of whether it's placebo or whether there's a verifiable, you know, scientific and health benefit for people. If it provides some relief to their pain, no matter how small, I think that's sort of one tool in the armament of tools that states have to really begin to help these patients in a different way and avoid abuse.
Well, and how would it work? We know Alabama, as you write, considered this, but then there were concerns about the administrative burden the expansion would put on, you know, the small group of providers they have. So they declined to do it. But what are some of the other questions that need to be answered before before these states can go forward?
Well, I think the most significant question that states are asking is can they afford to do this? The Medicaid budgets in states, as we know, are not necessarily growing. And in fact, Republicans in Congress are trying to find ways to cut the costs and pare the Medicaid program. So states really have to ask themselves, can we afford, under the budget constraints, to offer these kinds of treatments? You know, these are treatments that might cost $75 to $100 per visit. And if you're getting a number of visits, that adds up, and that's a significant cost to taxpayers and to Medicaid programs.
I'm wondering if they're asking also, can we afford not to? Ohio, for instance, has a huge opioid epidemic, and there's got to be a way to get some of the pain medication out of pain treatment for people who are becoming addicts.
Well, that's right. I mean, I live in Ohio, and it's a real significant problem here. Overdoses have really increased, and it's a constant battle that law enforcement and that political leaders are dealing with, and there's a sense that something has to be done, and it can't just be, okay, we're going to limit prescribing practices, because the underlying pain that patients feel is still there, so there's got to be a way to address it. And so I think liberalizing the options that patients might have to treat their pain in different ways is a primary focus, I know, of the governor and of other stakeholders.
Well, we'll continue to watch to see how this plays out. Casey Ross, National Hospital Reporter for STAT. Casey, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
The majority of the National Park Service Advisory Board has resigned in protest over Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's unwillingness to meet with them. They were Obama appointees, and their terms were supposed to conclude in May. Among the resigning board members, former Alaska Governor Tony Knowles, who wrote in his resignation letter to Zinke that he has a profound concern that the mission of the national parks has been set aside. The Interior Department has not commented. Joining us now on Skype from Seattle is Sally Jewell, former Interior Secretary under President Obama. Secretary Jewell, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. It's good to be back.
And what do you think about this, that 9 out of the 12 National Park Service Advisory Board members resigned?
Well, I think that they are making a very important statement, which is that the advisory board worked incredibly hard. They did really good work to highlight the value of the national parks to all Americans and to talk about what they needed to do in this next century. As we're in began the next century of the national parks in 2017, and to not have any meetings, to not have their phone calls returned, to not have any opportunity to have an audience with the officials at the Interior Department is really a slap in the face. And I think sometimes you have to make a statement, which is, hey, this work matters, and if you're not going to pay attention to us, perhaps a mass resignation is going to draw attention to this very important work that the federal government does on behalf of all Americans.
Why do you think the Interior Department was unwilling to meet with them?
You know, I can't speculate on their actions. I know they were reviewing all advisory boards, but they didn't seem to actually care about the work. And I would say that one thing that has been very consistent with this administration is that anything associated with the last administration, they seem to walk away from. And the fact that there are people, you know, on this advisory board that were have been working through Republican and Democratic administrations on behalf of the national parks doesn't seem to matter to them. So, you know, these are busy people that have a lot of things going on, that have dedicated much of their time, and they were being ignored. They didn't just feel like they were being ignored. They were being ignored. And I have to believe that's consistent with what this administration has done with other advisory boards and councils that have been around for a long time and other agencies as well.
By the way, this advisory board was established back in 1935. What is it that they do exactly?
Well, it's varied under different administrations. It's a congressionally mandated advisory board, and what they did for the last 5 years, or at least the prior four years where I was involved, is they took the work of the National Park Second Century Commission, of which I was a member as a private citizen, as were many members of the advisory board, and worked closely with the Park Service to put it into action. So highlighting the value of the parks in education, helping people understand the value of ecosystems, not just within the park, but outside, and how they, the work that needs to be done in order for them to be healthy ecosystems and unimpaired for future generations, as is the requirement under the Organic Act of the National Park Service. Making sure that they're there to tell the history and the story of all Americans, which has not traditionally been the case. And so you've seen, with advice from the National Park System Advisory Board, many more places that tell the story of African Americans, Latino Americans, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, LGBT Americans. And all of that comes from work done by the advisory committee over, you know, the last half dozen years or so, or even more, that has really shaped what the national park system needs to do in its next century in order to fulfill its mission.
Do you think that the national parks as we know them are at risk because of this administration?
Absolutely, the parks are at risk. Everybody knows that the infrastructure is crumbling, and that's something that the Trump administration likes to talk about, and Secretary Zinke talks about as well. And that is that there's now close to a $12 billion backlog. And they've talked about putting money into infrastructures and the national parks being a place to do it. But they have not taken any actions that support that or prioritize that. Our parks are in jeopardy. When you have an advisory board like this that has worked closely with career staff at the Park Service who have done really good work, including you know, working, for example, with Professor Bilmes at Harvard on a book that helps identify the economic value of the national parks, when you run the risk of devaluing that work, it demoralizes the people that are working there. And I think that we have seen that, and I've certainly heard from a number of people within the organization that they don't feel the kind of support that they did before. So if we lose the people with the knowledge and the ability to educate the next generation of young people to appreciate our history, our culture, our natural world, then we lose the value of the national parks that were set out in 1916 when the National Park Service was identified, or before that by Teddy Roosevelt with, you know, his designation of Yellowstone as a national park. So it's in jeopardy. There's no question.
And what about bigger picture? We've seen Secretary Zinke in recent months move to expand offshore drilling. He reduced the size of two national monuments in Utah. We've got the new tax bill, which opens up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge in Alaska to drilling. What do you think about all of this?
It's an all-out attack on public lands. And I don't know behind the scenes why the extractive industries appear to be driving everything about this agenda. I don't understand it, because when Secretary Zinke and I talked when he was still a congressman and he'd been nominated for the job, he said all the right things. But when it comes down to it, he's been doing all the wrong things, including opening up all of the Outer Continental Shelf to oil and gas drilling as his proposal for the five-year plan. I mean, are you kidding me? Places where people don't want it, as we now know about Florida. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, I have been there. I have flown over it. It is unique in the world in that it is an undisturbed area that, if oil and gas development goes forward, will be destroyed in a way that just makes me sick for future generations. And I don't understand why at this time of really very significantly changing economics in the energy sector and the technological innovations that allow us to develop oil and gas in areas that are already disturbed, why the administration would have gone forward with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, and frankly, why members of Congress on the Republican side that approved this tax bill would allow something so egregious to be in a completely unrelated piece of legislation. It is an attack on our public lands for the benefit of a few. And I don't know what's motivating them, but I suspect history will be the judge and it will not be kind.
And do you expect that any of this stuff is going to be reversible if there's a different administration that comes in later? Or is once this is done, can't be undone?
When oil and gas leases are let or mining land is approved for mining or mining claims are made, and you'd be amazed how easy it is to lay out a mining claim. Most land protections honor valid existing rights. So Congress can do what it wants, but if the administration leases these lands and provides a contract, if you will, for people to be able to go and explore or develop, those generally are honored in the future without congressional action. So the damage that they are doing could be long-lasting. In the case of drilling for offshore, that is a long process with lots of opportunities to check in. So while the headline of drilling everywhere in the outer continental shelf offshore certainly grabbed people's attention, there is a requirement that they take in a public input. And as we did when we were there, and our five-year plan reflected a lot of input that says don't drill in the Atlantic, don't drill in the Pacific with the exception of a few areas in Alaska, don't drill in the Arctic, and in fact take some of these places off entirely. So once contracts are let and leases are made, that is permanent damage you cannot reverse. But while it is just in the planning stages, there are a lot of things that can be done. And there will be people that are fighting for that.
That's Sally Jewell, the former Secretary of the Interior under President Obama. Secretary Jewell, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thanks for taking on this important topic, Jeremy.
A lot of people seek out experiences to push their limits, think skydiving, base jumping, but some go to even edgier extremes. Paige Flager from WHYY's The Pulse reports on a practice that looks scary, even disturbing, but it has a history that goes back centuries, and those who do it say it releases a lot of bottled up emotions. Still, we have to warn you, her story might make you feel a little squeamish.
Inside a windowless warehouse, Kirsten Januszewski is lying on her back on a massage table. She's wearing a bra and bike shorts and has dots of black marker all over her body, on her collarbones, her ribs, her thighs, her kneecaps, and her shins. Five people stand around her with rubber gloves and surgical face masks on. They each hold a large metal hook, about the size of a coat hanger.
Everybody good?
Yeah.
Come on, sweetie, whenever you're ready.
I'm ready.
Each of them pinches Kirsten's skin and lines the hookup with the dots of marker.
Just big deep breath from and out.
Then they drive the hooks through her flesh at the same time. Her eyes are closed and she's shaking.
Hi.
Kirsten is here to do body suspension, basically to hang from the ceiling by those hooks in her skin.
People run because it's an adrenaline and endorphin rush. You know, it releases, you know, those good feelings. Suspension does the same kind of thing. It's all those same kind of internal natural drugs that happen with it.
Sometimes she suspends as a celebration of something good going on in her life. And other times, like this one, she's suspending because things have been really hard lately.
Suspension definitely helps start that movement that, you know, more of a positive mental kind of attitude. It helps clear all that kind of negative emotions that I have going on.
She compares it to going to therapy, which would make this guy her therapist.
My name's Jeremy. My last name's Smart, the opposite of stupid. I'm actually the team leader for Skinthesis Body Suspension.
Jeremy came across body suspension years ago during a difficult time in his life. He's a veteran and was struggling with post-traumatic stress, so he decided to try it out. He remembers the first time the hooks went in and they started to lift him up.
When my feet left the floor, it was like a nuclear bomb went off inside me, and it just like all everything just pushed out at like the speed of light, and I felt completely rejuvenated and completely new and like a totally different human being.
He was, well, hooked. These days, every other weekend, he and his team meet at the warehouse and facilitate suspensions for other people.
All that negativity that's balled up and sits on your shoulders is like just letting the weight loose, you know. You defy gravity for a minute, and it's like it just nothing matters.
People have suspended themselves from hooks in Southeast Asia for thousands of years, but there hasn't been any research done on the impact of body suspension on the mind or the body.
I tried to peruse the medical literature if there was any comment or anything about it, and there wasn't really much that I could find.
That's dermatologist Jules Lipoff.
So I wouldn't want to overstate the risks. I wouldn't want to say you definitely can't ever do this, but medically, I can't really recommend it.
He has one main worry about body suspension.
Anytime there is a penetrating injury into the skin or any part of the body, there certainly is primarily a risk of infection. So even in the most sterile environments, like when we do surgeries or cut things out of the skin, still sometimes there are infections and risks.
Back at the warehouse, Kirsten Januszewski is ready to go. She assumes the position for her suspension, leaning back, one leg bent and the other straightened. Jeremy carefully loops a rope through the hooks, crisscrossing back and forth, forming a web between Kirsten and the rig hanging from the ceiling above her. The room is tense as the rig is raised slowly, pulling the hooks and stretching Kirsten's skin.
Keep breathing. Nice big deep breaths. Nice big deep breaths. Okay, baby, you're there. Beautiful. All the way good. She's up. She's up. Get her up. Get her up.
Her body leaves the table. Suddenly, she's floating in the air. She beams, letting her body relax. She hangs there for about 15 minutes, and Jeremy gently swings her the way a parent would a child on a swing set. She asks to come back down, and the moment her body hits the table, she begins to cry. Jeremy kneels next to the table and holds her hands, encouraging her to let go.
Thank you, guys. Very much. Thank you for making me cry too. I needed it. You know that feeling that you get after like a massage where you feel really, really light? Yeah, that's what you feel like. That's what I feel like. It just feels like my body is weightless right now. It's awesome.
For Here and Now, I'm Paige Flager.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.